injured. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Truppen, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services. More information is available at 356-3736. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan for State of Illinois employees and is accepting new patients.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Bill Clinton denied improper relations with intern Monica Lewinsky. Then he confessed, calling himself a sinner. Other public figures caught in sexual scandal have also confessed, leading them back to acceptance by the public. Those who don't admit to their sins and do so with the right words and in the right context find their public lives in jeopardy. This afternoon, we'll take a look at the act of public confession. Our guest is historian Susan Wise Bauer. She is the author of The Art of the Public Grovel, Sexual Sin and Public Confession in America. The book looks at how we got to the public grovel through an examination of a number of scandals involving public figures, as well as a look at the rise of evangelicals in America. She begins with Grover Cleveland and ends with Cardinal Bernard Law. In between, there are chapters that look at other public figures, including Amy Semple McPherson, Jim Baker, Ted Hagar, Jimmy Carter, and Bill Clinton. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Susan Wise Bauer. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Susan Wise Bauer, is the author of The History of the Ancient World, which is the first part of a four-volume history of the world. Her other books include The Well-Trained Mind and The Educated Mind. All three are published by Norton. Her new book, The Art of the Public Grovel, Sexual Sin and Public Confession in America, is published by Princeton. And you'll find our guest online at www.susanwisebauer.com. And that's B-A-U-E-R. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Susan Bauer, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You say the public confession has come to serve a very particular purpose. It's become a ceremonial laying down of power made so that followers could pick that power up and hand it back. What happens in that exchange?
What happens is that the leader who has been, we assume, caught doing something to gratify his own desires, and these are mostly men we're talking about here, the leader's been caught doing something to gratify himself rather than serving his constituency. And when he goes through this act of public confession, he is telling his constituency, his followers, those who vote for him, that he remembers they're in charge, he remembers that he's there to serve them, he remembers that they're actually calling the shots. So it's this act of sort of a submission and humility, recognizing that power belongs with the people and not with the leaders that they've elected.
Hmm. And what do the people get out of this exchange?
Satisfaction and reassurance, I think, is a really big thing. I think, and particularly in election years, I think many Americans just feel kind of powerless to really affect policies. They feel powerless to make their leaders do what they think should be done. And this sort of ceremonial offering of forgiveness to a leader makes you feel powerful. Giving forgiveness to someone who's groveling makes you feel like you're in the driver's seat. And it may be a little bit of an illusion, but it's extremely comforting.
Yeah. What happens to those who don't ceremonially lay down that power?
In most cases, particularly if they've been involved in some sort of sexual sin which has predatory overtones, preying on someone in a subordinate position, particularly in that case, their public careers are in real jeopardy. They are seen as willing to grab what they want no matter who they hurt in the process. And that's not a quality you want to see in someone who is supposed to be a public servant. That's the term that we use.
Mm. Well, one of the difficulties facing Grover Cleveland, whom you begin with, is the idea of predator. What was the scandal? He refused to speak of the matter. How was it handled?
This is a very interesting case. Cleveland was rumored to have fathered a child out of wedlock, which, you know, this is in the 19th century. This is not something that you were supposed to do or admit to if you did. And it was something that could have torpedoed his chance of being elected president, particularly since this came out as he was running a campaign on sort of a clean up the mess, I'm the righteous candidate sort of platform. Always awkward to get caught in sexual misdeeds when you are campaigning for change. And what he managed to do was to portray himself as the victim in this particular instance. He managed to spin it very carefully so that he appeared to be the victim of a rapacious female. And he came out sort of looking like the good guy. What's important to remember about Cleveland is that although this strategy, making sure you look like the good guy and not like a predator, is something that remains very relevant for the next 100 years, Cleveland, coming in the era before TV talk shows, before radio call-in shows, before the Internet, did not face the same demand to lay out his sins publicly. One thing that changes between Cleveland and Clinton is that this practice of confession as a way to lay down your power comes out fully into the public view, becomes something which is demanded of any leader who is in the public eye. Cleveland didn't face quite that same pressure to publicly talk about what he'd done.
Also, his opponent had offended the people in a very different kind of way, a different kind of scandal, but nonetheless,
yes,
he didn't handle it well.
Well, Cleveland was helped a great deal by the fact that his opponent was essentially caught engaging in some very shady financial dealings with some very, very rich people. So while Cleveland was able to spin himself as a victim, he was also able to sort of, you know, point again very discreetly and very indirectly at his opponent and say, "You want to know who's really taking advantage of you? This guy over here. He's in the pocket of the wealthy men. He's not on the side of the common man. He's not on your side. He's only out for his own gain." And that also helped Cleveland to recover from this scandal, because the financial misdealings seemed much more serious in the eyes of the public.
Yeah. Do we see the public grovel in other types of scandals?
There are two major kinds of scandals that risk sort of booting the person who committed them out of office: financial misdealings mm-hmm. and sexual misdealings. With financial misdealings, it's sort of paradoxically often best if the culprit says as little about what is going on as possible, because when a leader is caught abusing public funds, there's no longer any question in our minds as to whether or not he might be taking advantage of his position for his own gain. He's obviously taking advantage of his position for his own gain. He's got his hand in the treasury. There's not much he can do, or the offering plate. There's not much that he can do to recover our trust after that. A sexual sin, on the other hand, only puts in our minds the suspicion that this leader might be out for his own gain. It's the sexual sin becomes a stand-in for the greater sins that he might commit. And this is why the American public is sort of hung up on the sexual sins of our leaders, again, particularly those that seem to involve some sort of predatory behavior. It's a pointer. It's a clue to us. It's a signpost that this guy may not be trustworthy when it comes to other matters, legal matters, financial matters.
Hmm. Why did you begin with Grover Cleveland?
I began with Cleveland because he was the first. Sort of American public figure who even approached something like a public confession. What he did was he confessed in private to a Protestant minister who was a friend of his, and then allowed that minister to make known that Cleveland had confessed and given an explanation, and that the minister had forgiven him, and the explanation seemed, you know, to be perfectly reasonable to him. So he did confess publicly. He just sort of did it. He did it indirectly. He did it through a substitute. And so for me, that shows that public confession is at that point beginning to move into the limelight. And part of what the book does is traces the act of public confession as it moves from this indirect act out sort of into the full, you know, public glare, public spotlight.
Yeah. Bill Clinton did it perfectly. Tell us about
Eventually.
That. Eventually. That's right. And with the help of some ministers.
Yes, with the help of some ministers. It's an interesting sort of tracing Clinton's series of first avoiding answering questions, denials, through a sort of increasing openness until finally at the prayer breakfast where he made his most open confession, he stands up and basically says, "I am a sinner and I need you to forgive me." Tracing that sort of series of confessions shows a man who was very, very responsive to the American people, always saying what he saw that they wanted to hear. He saw that his initial confessions were not open enough, gave the impression that he was hiding something. He continually adapted his confessions to the reactions of the public. And when it became clear to him that nothing but sort of a full public grovel was going to do the trick, he confessed as openly as he could without bringing legal sanction down on his head. He used these very important words, "I am a sinner, I need you to forgive me," sort of putting himself on the same level as the people he's speaking to. And then he promised that he was going to form an accountability group, this very sort of evangelical thing where men get together and hold each other to a high moral standard. And he asked several very high-profile evangelical and Protestant ministers to be in this accountability group with him. So he was sort of reassuring the American people, hey, somebody's keeping an eye on me. I can't do whatever I want. I can't fulfill my own desires, no matter what they are. I've got people who are keeping tabs on me.
Mm. And at the same time, he was also allowing us to feel his pain.
Yes. He was, it still is, you know, and just a genius at putting himself on the same level as sort of the common man, you know. He's just like us. He feels our pain. He has the same struggles that we do. This is a really large part, I think, of the success of his confession, was his ability to appear just like, you know, anybody else.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Susan Weisbauer, author most recently of The Art of a Public Grovel, Sexual Sin and Public Confession in America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in DeWitt County on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. First, I was wanting to bring up, it's not in a sexual light, but rather murder. That's Henry II and Thomas Becket, of course, where the king had to actually make a full apology to the church and be scourged by monks or priests or somebody. But that was... Now, of course, only murder and not the worst crime of sex that we have these days. Also, with President Clinton, I was wondering if there was any higher hypocrisy than when Reverend Jesse Jackson left his wife at home and took his mistress to the White House, his pregnant mistress, to give counseling to the adulterous President Clinton?
Well, let me take those things one at a time. Henry II and the murder of Becket is an interesting parallel. There are two ways, I think, in which we'd want to distinguish that from what a public leader now has to go through when he sins. The first is that the public confession is something that takes place in a democratic system. It's only in a democracy that the leader has this relationship with the followers, that they put him in office, they can take him out. He is answerable to them in this very concrete way. If he doesn't do what they want him to do, they will no longer follow him. And it's not quite the same thing when you have a monarchy. Now, what you see with Henry II, though, is that there was a body which was able to hold him to account, and in that case, it was the church. There's a very different relationship, however, between a monarch and the church. Than there is between an elected leader and the voters who put him in office. As far as Jesse Jackson goes, I would like to emphasize before somebody else brings it up that this particular book is about sort of public performance. What a leader does in order to convince people that he's sincere. Yeah. I would not want to comment on issues of hypocrisy. I think that has more to do with motivations than actual, actual performance of a ritual.
Mm.
So that's not something I think that I would care to comment on.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. But maybe you can say a word or two about the idea of remorse, and does that need to come through somehow? We need to feel that this performance is genuine. It's not a performance, really. It's a confession.
Absolutely. And what's incredibly important about this performance is, as you say, that it appears to be completely unscripted. Again, this is one of the things I think that Clinton did so well. You can't tell me that he didn't have speechwriters laboring over every word he was going to say at that prayer breakfast. It was a very carefully designed speech. But he was able to deliver it with this appearance of spontaneity, which is very, very important. Again, remember that the confession acts to reassure us that the leader is just the same as we are. He doesn't think he's better than we are. He doesn't think he's greater or more privileged or deserving of greater satisfaction. And so he has to sound like one of us. He can't sound like he's got 8 speechwriters shaping every word, because we don't. He has to sound spontaneous and genuine, because that's how we would want to sound in the same situation. And Clinton was just a master of that.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana. Line 1, hi.
Hey, I just want to echo that actually the concern about hypocrisy, because I think part of what it is that these public officials have such a disconnect between the kinds of public policy they want to enforce on others and the personal morality they hold themselves to. So whether it's Ted Haggard exploiting these guys in his church or sleeping with a prostitute, whether it's Bill Clinton signing the Defense of Marriage Act and the sexual harassment laws, whether it's Eliot Spitzer going after people who break these laws that he's himself breaking, I think the hypocrisy is the key element in it. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
I think that what we really don't want to see is a leader setting himself apart from the standards that he's going to hold us to. That implies that he thinks of himself as better than we are. We need to do this. He doesn't need to do it. I don't know that I'd use the word hypocrisy. I would prefer to use the word entitlement or privilege.
Mm.
We don't like it when these guys see themselves as above the law, because they're seeing themselves as privileged. And in a democratic system, they're not privileged. They are just like us. We elected them. They answer to us. Again, they are public servants. And anything that makes them appear more like monarchs, more like Henry II, saying, I'm just going to do this. I don't need to follow this law, but all of you little people need to. Anything they do that strikes us in this way is going to very definitely put their public careers in jeopardy. And again, sexual sin is one of those ways in which a leader sort of, appears to be taking the spoils, taking advantage of his position to, you know, behave like an aristocrat, behave like Henry VIII with all of his wives while, you know, the rest of us are struggling along with our single spouse. It's not a sort of privilege that we can put up with.
Yeah. Eliot Spitzer is an interesting situation, an interesting story, because, you know, he was governor of the state of New York. Prior to that, he was the state's top lawman. He was the attorney general.
Yeah.
So is the public gravel not available to someone like him, or is it something, is it a case where he decided against that, or somehow it's not within him to be able to do it?
I couldn't comment on whether or not it's within him.
Right.
I don't know that it would have done any good. I think that the disconnect in his case between what he did and what he said was so wide that he could not have apologized for it in any convincing manner. You know, it was sort of a very long-running pattern of enforcing laws that he himself did not feel like he had to obey. When you've got a pattern of behavior that's sort of that ingrained, I don't actually think there's anything that could have saved him. I think his rapid disappearance from the political scene was a very realistic recognition of that.
Mm. When he stepped down as governor, he was succeeded by David Paterson, who is currently the governor of the state of New York, who not long after becoming governor, he held a news conference with his wife by his side to acknowledge that they had had extramarital affairs. And he said he was being open and forthcoming because he didn't want to be compromised, his word, in the future.
Yeah.
Is that a preemptive grovel?
Very preemptive, very, very preemptive, and very smart. Again, look at the difference between what he is confessing to, though, and what Spitzer would have confessed to. Not just him. I mean, as I, it was both of them, wasn't it? I mean, it was he wasn't standing there and saying, I have wronged my wife. I have taken advantage of someone who is vulnerable. I have been unfaithful and broken my vows while, injuring another person. It was, look, I messed up, she messed up, we messed up together. We just want you to know that. Now we're going to move on. He never appeared to be victimizing or taking advantage of anyone because, you know, she was right there by his side sort of making the same confession. It was smart. You know, it's kind of cringe-making, but smart.
Yeah. Also, he apparently wanted to make the point that neither one of them had been wrong in terms of their public duties.
Again, there's sort of different levels to these sexual sins. An extramarital affair with another, you know, consenting spouse, if you're a public official, is bad, but it doesn't have to be a career ender. Taking advantage of page boys in the Senate, there's no way to spin that so that you don't look like a predator. And there's not much of a way to recover from that.
Also, it's not enough to say, I'm sorry. What's the formula?
To say I'm sorry, that's an apology. There's a big difference between an apology and a confession, and I think this is very important. You can apologize without taking any personal responsibility. If you've ever listened to two people fight who don't know how to fight fair, they will say things like, well, I'm sorry if you feel that way, or I'm sorry that I made you feel angry. You're expressing some kind of regret, but there's absolutely no confession that you yourself did anything wrong there. A confession is when you say, I have sinned in some form. I did wrong. And a confession is what makes you appear accountable to your followers. You have to remember that the kind of confession, public confession that we're accustomed to, has its roots in this evangelical Protestant practice of, you know, one Christian standing up in a congregation of other Christians and saying, I'm a sinner just like you. We are all redeemed by grace that's greater than us. We're all in the same in the sight of God. We're all equal sinners. None of us are better. None of us earn salvation by being good. It's this intensely egalitarian, leveling, democratic thing you do where you all confess that you're the same. And so a public confession has to contain some of that religious language that I have sinned. And I think it's amazing when you look at these very secular, successful confessions, including Clinton's, how much religious language they use in order to, you know, convey this sense of repentance.
It's interesting on a number of fronts, the case of Cardinal Bernard Law, because here is a man who is familiar with confession, mm-hmm. but not public confession.
Right.
He is the Catholic Church. One confesses one's sins, and it's between you and your priest.
Mm-hmm.
What could Law have done, or what should he have done, to be more sensitive to what needed to be done?
Mm. I think what he needed to do ran so counter to everything that he understood about his role in the Catholic Church that it would have been almost impossible for him to do. What he needed to do was say, I sin. Now remember, he was not at all personally suspected of wrongdoing, you know, in terms of you know, sexual misdeeds of any kind. The sin, the wrongdoing that he needed to confess was the cover-up, the not being careful, the putting the welfare of priests who had already been convicted of child abuse, putting their welfare ahead of the welfare of their congregations. That's what he needed to confess. What he needed to do was stand up and say, I have heard you, all you people in the pews, all you people who are indignant, I heard you. I have not been responsive enough to you. I have not cared enough about your well-being. I have not felt myself accountable to you, and from now on, I will be. Now, that would have gone a long way towards resolving the situation. And that's the sort of thing that you would see in a more Protestant evangelical setting, because there's this intense emphasis on all of us, both the leaders and the followers, you know, both the pastor and the congregation being equal in the sight of God. But in the Catholic Church, you have this much stronger hierarchy. You have a much stronger series of not horizontal but vertical relationships where if you're the cardinal, you are not responsible to the person in the pew. You don't answer to them. They didn't put you in power. You know, in a Protestant church, the congregation essentially, you know, picks the minister and keeps him in power. In the Catholic Church, the cardinal, you know, the leader, whoever this is appointed from above. And so he had no formal responsibility to the people in the pews to be their quote-unquote servant, to answer to them. And he would have had to acknowledge in his confession that he did. But in the Catholic Church, his authority is not even set up that way. You know, it's almost as though it was outside of his paradigm, outside of his ability to understand his role in the church, for him to make himself accountable to the person in the pew.
Yeah. Is that also the situation in terms of what happened to Ted Kennedy?
Definitely. I think Kennedy was in much the same boat. People wanted to hear him say that he had done wrong, and he didn't. You know, he said, I had a concussion. He said, I regret this. I'm sorry. He didn't say, I have sinned. And I think, you know, if we were to speculate, which I do try not to do, but in this case, if we were to speculate, he may well have made a confession in private to a priest, but he did not see this as something that needed or should be done publicly. It's just not part of his mental picture of the world.
Yeah. Where are we now in terms of the public grovel? Are we? Do you think there might come a time when we tire of it? We say, yeah, yeah, yeah.
There might. The fact that an elected official takes the opportunity to confess now before anybody even finds out he's done something wrong,
uh-huh.
perhaps suggests that we're moving in the other direction, that this is becoming a ritual which is going to become more important than ever. You know, the more powerless we feel as voters and the more we despair over the way our country seems to be heading, the more important these ritual gestures of responsiveness and accountability from our leaders become. I think you could argue that, you know, if, you know, economic conditions get worse, if, you know, if we get involved in another unpopular war, that the level of frustration felt by the American people is going to make the act of public confession even more necessary than it is now. And we'll just have to wait and see, but I think that's a strong possibility.
Yeah. You know, we've seen scandals that are not sex scandals, but are scandals that have injured others, other Americans, their jobs, their savings,
mm-hmm.
their health,
mm-hmm.
The sense of fair play diminished.
Mm-hmm.
Enron, Peanut Corporation of America, Bernard Madoff,
right,
so on and so forth, sports figures mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible in these situations? I guess earlier you talked about the gravel. It's not so easy when there's money on the line or when there's criminal charges
right.
pending. But what's possible here to if we look at the gravel in terms of its redemptive factors,
mm-hmm.
What's possible and can it help us feel that we have been in some way restored?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that in the cases you describe that it would. I think what's important to remember here is, I know I keep saying that the public confession is this ritual which reassures us. The reason why it becomes so important for two kinds of figures, leaders, religious leaders and political leaders, to perform this grovel is because the only people they have to hold them, you know, accountable are the people who put them in office or the people who follow them. When you're dealing with a corporation, you know, Enron, or when you're dealing with someone like Madoff, you have a very different relationship. You didn't put that person in office. You know, you didn't elect them. There are, in the case of a company or a corporation, you know, an executive that's accused of misusing funds, there are other ways for that company to hold him responsible. He can answer to shareholders. You know, he's got to answer if he's actually, you know, if he's broken the law, he answers to law enforcement. But we have a different relationship with people that we have not elected, approved, been willing to place in office and willingly submit ourselves to. I think it is political and religious leaders in particular that we have this very uneasy relationship with. We put them in office or we put them in the pulpit, but we did so with this mental reservation. They're just like me. You know, you think about our national myth of any boy can become a president. Any boy can become president. The sort of flip side of that is the president is essentially just like the rest of us, you know. And it's that quality in our elected leaders that we require constant reassurance about. Yeah, this is a regular guy. This is just a regular guy. This is just a regular guy. And that kind of reassurance is just particularly acute when we're talking about leaders that we have decided to follow. We're not following a sports figure, you know. He doesn't have power mm-hmm. over us. Someone that we're investing money with, we have other ways to hold that man to account. But we don't really have much of a way to hold, our pastor to account except to demand that he grovel if he steps out of line.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, historian Susan Wise Bauer, author of The Art of the Public Grovel, Sexual Sin and Public Confession in America. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455 if you'd like to join the discussion. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Just a couple of comments. On Ted Kennedy's not apologizing, he did, if I remember correctly, in the speech that he gave that was televised shortly after the accident, mentioned that he had a number of thoughts, inexcusable, inappropriate thoughts. I think the word he used was inexcusable, that went through his head, that he was acting irrationally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you consider that an apology, but something of that sort. Two, and Spitzer, maybe I'm just ill-informed, but as far as I'm aware, Spitzer's quote-unquote crimes were of a, not really crimes, but were of a sexual nature, that he was prosecuting gentlemen on Wall Street for financial misdealings. But as far as I'm aware, that he did not engage in financial misdealings himself. Now, I could be wrong on that. And three, on law, I don't think his goal was so much to protect the priests themselves as much as to protect the image of the church, which maybe they're the same, but I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
This last point is a very good one, and I think there's much truth in that. He was trying to protect the quote-unquote image of the church or the health of the church, the way it looked, I don't know. So you could certainly look at it in that way. Either way, I think his concern was to do so by exerting his authority and refusing to admit that he had done anything wrong. I think the sense that he had was that to admit that he had erred, to admit that he had made a huge, huge, huge error in judgment, that he had sinned, would weaken the authority of the church. And this was sort of, you know, primary in his mind. He needed to maintain the authority of the church. Kennedy, if you look at, and, you know, I actually have the entire text of his television speech in one of the appendices for the book. The problem with what he did was that it was all focused on him. He kept talking about how injured he was, about how fuzzy his thought was, about how concussed he was, about how he says he was in a state of utter exhaustion and alarm. He had a cerebral concussion, and that's why all these thoughts were going through his head. He's on TV talking about what bad shape he was in. And, you know, everyone's sitting there watching and thinking, but she's dead, you know. She drowned. You left her there in the most sort of in the most literal way possible. He abandoned someone who was helpless to save himself. And so his emphasis on his own state of mind only served, I think, to make him look more like a predator. Didn't do him any favors at all.
And Spitzer?
You know, I will tell you the truth. Since the book came out, I've been trying to keep up with all of the scandals, and I can't generally remember all of the details. It seems to me that there was some financial misdealing from him, but I would not swear to that.
Yeah, okay. We've been talking about men here, but there is a woman in the book, Amy Semple McPherson.
Mm-hmm.
What was her story? Can you give us it in a nutshell, and how did she cope with the scandal?
Amy Semple McPherson is sort of there by way of contrast, almost. She had disappeared, and it was assumed by everyone, including her mother, that she had drowned, and they had a funeral service. And then she turned back up a few weeks later with the story that she had been kidnapped and for ransom and forced and held in captivity in the desert and had finally managed to escape, you know, in this sort of Perils of Pauline way and make her way to a police station. And almost at once, a lot of questions were raised about the accuracy of her story. And it seems almost certain that rather than being held captive in the desert, she was actually hanging out on the beach with her married sound engineer, which was, you know, not something that a minister was supposed to be doing. McPherson never confessed at all. She never confessed. She cast every single attack on her story as a satanic and demonic attack on her ministry. And because she was female, it was much, much easier for her to cast herself as the victim and not the predator. And I think one reason why we see so many of these confessions from men, and when I was working on the book, I tried really hard to find a high-profile public grovel from a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And really the only thing you can find is, you know, women who are forced to admit that they have improperly paid their household help. That is pretty much it for the women. It's men in our society who are in the positions of power that allow them to be predators. And it is men, almost without exception, who are forced into this ceremonial laying down of power. Women don't occupy the same position of power in our culture, and they are not required to make the same sort of humiliated grovel, because we're not as afraid that they're going to grab power and run away with it.
Mm. So there's a sexual sin ceiling.
Yes, there definitely is.
Okay.
We should be grateful for what we can get.
Let's take another call. A listener in Crawfordsville, Indiana, line 4. Hi.
Hi. Great show, great topic, especially for the times. Number one, being a cradle Catholic, I found the most offensive thing of the whole priest scandal was, like your guest had said, and you said, the tremendous cover-up. The same with you know, the President Clinton. And I'm not sure how much groveling or apologies you could make that really sounds sincere after you've done such a masterful job trying to cover it up to start with and only come to the table after you've been caught and come kicking and screaming. So if your guest might have a thought about that, I'll hang up and listen off air.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. Clinton had to do some really fancy footwork to cover up for his earlier denials. He'd have been a lot better off in the long run if he'd just admitted it up front. It would have been a much smaller story. Of course, he undoubtedly thought that it, you know, wouldn't come out in the open. His denials made it very difficult for him to appear honest and sincere. And the way that he got around that was by pointing out in a number of different ways that that he was under attack, that he had to deny because Kenneth Starr was out to get him, that the whole thing was a plot. I mean, can anybody forget Hillary Clinton's great right-wing conspiracy? He had to, again, portray himself as the victim. I was forced into a falsehood because I knew they were out to get me, and if I admitted it, they would have just used it to crucify me, and I didn't deserve that because the conspiracy was after me. And he did it very successfully. You know, he managed to get around those denials. If you deny first, you really got to work hard, and that's exactly what he did.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the talk show before we're out of time.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are on the talk show,
mm-hmm.
although we don't do much business in terms of confessional talk show here.
Right.
A couple questions. How has it captured the spirit of the Protestant revival, and what role has the talk show played in the rise of the public confession?
Yeah, well, this is obviously a much bigger topic than, you know, I can address in the next couple of minutes.
Right.
But just a couple of thoughts. The talk show borrows heavily from the confessional rituals that take place in an evangelical church. So you stand up, you confess your sin, and the rest of the congregation says, "Amen, we witness, hallelujah, we're pray for you, we're just like you, brother," you know, and maybe also offer some, you know, helpful suggestions. You know, keep on fighting, keep on praying, here's how you can avoid temptation. And this is pretty much what happens, you know, in the talk show setting. You know, the guest comes on, there's a confession, you know, all the way from, you know, the sort of more highbrow, "I struggle with an eating disorder," down to the, you know, more sort of, you know, "I was sleeping with my sister's boyfriend, who was also my first cousin." There's this big confession, and then everybody in the audience gets to chime in. You know, there gets to be this big participatory, it's like a secular, "Amen, hallelujah, we're with you on this." So the form of the talk show, where you've got one person confessing and then everybody else witnessing and chiming on in there, is very indebted to the form of the Protestant evangelical confession. It's interesting that this form actually sort of got its start with radio psychotherapy. If you trace the very, very deepest roots of the TV talk show, you can trace them back to the practice in mid-century of, you know, the first online therapy shows. A therapist, psychologist, psychiatrist would have a call-in show, and people would call in and tell her their problems or him their problems, and he would diagnose and treat them right there on the air. It's the same as the television talk show, except that the audience is invisible. You know, they're sitting mm-hmm. at their radios, so they can yell hallelujah, amen, but nobody's going to hear them. That form then gave way to the television talk show, where the audience listening is no longer invisible. They're right there. You know, they can chime on in. So there's a pretty direct line from the radio talk show up to the TV confessional talk show.
Yeah. Well, that makes me think about the Bakers.
They were in a
really tough spot there, because here they're running the confessional,
mm-hmm.
and they're the ones suddenly in trouble.
Yeah, yeah. One of the most puzzling aspects of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker's story is why they didn't, I mean, I think at that point they must have just figured they were in such deep trouble they couldn't say anything, but why they didn't use that platform that they built for themselves to confess.
Mm.
You know, Baker didn't even go on his own show to talk about it. They built this whole empire around this confessional form, and then they didn't use it. And that, more than anything else, convinced people that they thought of themselves as better than the rest of us. We might need to confess, but they don't need to confess. And they didn't help this by continuing to lead this very lavish lifestyle while their whole story was unraveling around them. Everything that they did, including their avoidance of their own confessional, you know, sort of form, conveyed the message that they thought that they were better. They thought that they didn't have to do this. They weren't accountable. They weren't answerable. That does not go across well.
Mm. What inspired you to take a look at the art of the public grovel?
Well, it sort of has its roots actually back when I was in college. I was actually a college student at Jerry Falwell's University in Lynchburg long, long ago, and during the whole Baker scandal. And we sort of got, you know, daily chapel updates on what was going on. And I was fascinated, you know, even then by his Baker's unwillingness to say he'd done anything wrong and by his refusal to be accountable to anyone. And, you know, he went to jail, and when he got out of jail, he published an autobiography, and the title of it was I Was Wrong. And I thought, oh, my goodness, he's finally said it. And I ran out and bought it. And I don't think I've ever seen so many ways to say I am wrong while simultaneously avoiding any confession of sin. You know, he says, I was wrong to trust people. I was wrong to believe that my wife would stand by me. I was wrong to put myself in the hands of those that I thought had my best interest at heart but obviously didn't. And by the time I finished it, I thought, I got to write about this. I've got to write about confessions that work and confessions that don't, because this one doesn't work.
Mm. Fascinating topic. Susan Wise Bauer, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Sure.
Susan Wise Bauer is a historian. Her new book, The Art of the Public Grovel, Sexual Sin and Public Confession in America, is published by Princeton. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, let's find out what happened today in Kansas City and Chicago. Here with settlement prices from the Boards of Trade, Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. Looking at those numbers on a Friday afternoon, a final work day and business day of the week. May futures in the wheat pit from Chicago, soft red winter. Down a nickel today, the high price at $5.61, the low 20 cents beyond below that at $5.41. With a settlement price at $5.50 and a quarter, down 5 cents on the day for the May soft red winter wheat in Chicago. The harvest month, July, $5.73 the high, the low at $53 and three quarter. Settlement price at $5.62 and a half, down 5 and a quarter in September. $5.96 the high, the low at $77 and a half. Settlement price at $5.86 and three quarters, down 5 cents. December future, $6.18 and a half the high, the low at $6. Settlement price at $6.08 and three quarters, down 4.5 cents. In the March contract, $6.24 and a half the high, the low at 17. Settlement price at $6.24, 4.5 lower. May wheat in Kansas City down 3 at $6.03. The harvest month July down 2 and three quarters at $6.14. From the corn pit in Chicago, nearby contract May futures unchanged on the day, $3.98 the high, the low at $3.93 and a half. Settlement price at $3.96 and a half. Finished the day unchanged for the May corn. July futures, $4.08 and a half the high, low at $4.04. Settlement price at $4.07 unchanged. In September, $4.17 and a half the high, the low at $4.14 and a half. Settled at $4.16 a quarter lower. In December contract, to $4.29 and three quarters top, bottom at $4.25 and a quarter. Settled at $4.28, 1/4 of a cent lower. March futures unchanged for 2010 with a $4.40 and a quarter top, bottom at $36.5, and a settlement price for the March corn at $4.39 and a quarter. Finished again unchanged on the afternoon. May oat futures, $2. The settlement price down a penny. July at $2.08 and three quarters, down 1 cent. The high there at $2.09 and three quarters, low at $2.07. From the soy complex, lead option May futures a $9.53 top, bottom at $9.35 and a quarter. Settlement price 11.5 cents higher at $9.52. July a $9.50 top, bottom at $34 and three quarters. Settlement price at $9.49, up 9. And the August a $9.32 the high, the low at $23. Settlement price at $9.32 and a half, 5 and a quarter higher. September soybeans $9.05 and a half the high, the low at $8.97 and a half. Settlement price at $9.05 and a half, 2 and three quarters higher on the afternoon. And November beans, an $8.97 top, the bottom at $8.83 and three quarters, rooting for a $9, and you got an $8.93, up a half for the day. January futures, $9.06 the high, the low at $8.95, settlement price at $9.03, up 1 1/2 for the January 2010 contract. May bean meal futures, $3.01 the high, the low at $2.94.60, settlement price at $300.50, up $4.20. July at $295.80, up $2.80 on the afternoon. May bean oil futures, $32.49 the high, the low at $31.83. Settled at $32.25, finished 36 cents higher. July contract for the soybean oil, $32.73 the high, the low at $32.19. Settled at $32.52, up 36 cents on the afternoon. In just about 10 minutes now, we'll talk with Mike Zuzlow during the closing mark report. He's at Risk Management Commodities Incorporated out of Lafayette, Indiana, and will help us take a complete look at the day's trade and the weekly trade as well as we go through the closing mark report this afternoon. Then closer to the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Bruce Bostard. He's from the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. All happens in just 10 minutes right here on the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's 4 minutes before 2 o'clock, and before we go to the livestock contracts, the Champaign Centennial Boys Basketball Team will be in tomorrow's championship game in the 3A Boys Basketball Tournament. It was a squeaker this afternoon in Peoria. The score, Champaign Centennial 66, Chicago North Lawndale 65. Let's turn our attention now to the livestock contracts. April live cattle, the high 85.80, the low 85 even, the settlement 85.20, up 45. June, 83.65, the high 82.75, the low 82.85, the settlement that down 27.5. August, 84.85, the high 84.02.5, the low 84.07.5, the settlement that down 15. October, 88.35, the high 87.60, the low 87.72.5, the settlement that down 25. March feeder cattle, 94.40, the high 93.65, the low 93.67.5, the settlement that down 57.5. April, 94.70, the high 93.70, the low, the settlement 93.77.5. Down 52.5. May 96.15, the high 95.05, the low 95.37.5, the settlement that down 35. August 99.20, the high 98.10, the low, the settlement 98.22.5, that down 67.5. April lean hog 62.65, the high 61.70, the low 61.75, the settlement that down 30. May 73.90, the high, the low 72.85, the settlement 73.30, that down 17.5. June 75.32.5, the high 73.60, the low, the settlement 73.77.5, that down 117.5. July 76.30, the high 74.50, the low 74.55, the settlement that down 122.5. May pork bellies 91.50, the high 89.52.5, the low 91.50, the settlement that down 25. It's a minute and a half before 2 o'clock. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. The Dow is off 130 at 7271. The NASDAQ off 27 at 1457. The S&P 500 off 17 at 767. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frayne. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. Coming up, it's the closing market report following news from National Public Radio. And then later this afternoon, I'll talk with someone at Parkland College. Parkland College has embarked on an effort to bridge the digital divide. Part-time faculty members, with the help of other faculty, students, and a state grant, getting computers into the hands of those who haven't had access to computers. So following the closing market report this afternoon, I'll talk with Brian Bell about that initiative. The forecast for Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, sunny, the high around 50, the wind from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, increasing cloudiness, the low 35. Tomorrow, intervals of clouds and sunshine, the high 55. For Illinois and Indiana this afternoon, mostly sunny. Highs ranging from 40 in far northeastern Indiana to 60 in southwestern Illinois. Tonight, in northwestern and west central Illinois, increasing cloudiness with a chance for a few scattered showers.